Thad put his arm around the little boy, and they headed for the door. Outside, Tony started around to the passenger side of the truck, but Thad called to him, "Hey, come on over here." The boy walked around to the driver's side as Thad climbed in. Thad looked at him, then patted his lap and asked, "You want to drive?" The response was immediate and overwhelming, and Thad thought Tony was going to stomp him to death climbing up into his lap. Thad backed the truck out of the drive and straightened it out on the road, and then let go of the wheel. "You take it from here," he said. Thad worked the gas and brake and let the boy steer the truck in a wobbly path toward the old man's house. The two of them fed all the animals and brought in the few eggs laid overnight, and then, using a wagon from the shed, they brought all the items the thieves had carried out back into the house. Thad put all the food back in the pantry and placed the guns back in the gun rack. By now, Tony was hungry, so Thad went into the kitchen, where he found 3 biscuits on a plate on the table, covered with cheesecloth. Laying a plate on the table, he took a spoon from the drawer and set a jar of honey out. Little Tony needed no more explanation. While Tony ate, Thad went through the house. Mr. Jackson had lived there a long, long time. He felt like he was trespassing, that being there was just wrong. Then he thought about what the old man had said to him, and that eased his tension a bit. The house was well suited for life without electricity, as it had been built before there was power in the area. In the living room was a big fireplace made from large pieces of stone. In the kitchen was still an old wood stove. There was a gas stove as well, but Thad was certain there wouldn't be any gas for it. Out back of the house was a pitcher pump that still worked, and a spring house over a small spring that ran clear, cold water, so water wasn't going to be an issue. The more Thad walked around and looked at the house, the better he felt about things. As he was coming down the hall toward the living room, Tony met him, honey on his face and hands.
"I need to wash my hands, Daddy," the boy said, his face shiny with honey and a quick tongue working all the places he could reach.
Thad smiled. He took Tony into the bathroom and grabbed a washcloth, then spotted some cotton balls on a shelf over the toilet. With a big smile on his face, he took one and walked back out to the hall and handed the cotton ball to the boy and said, "Here, wipe your hands with this." Thad had a big evil grin on his face. Tony took the cotton and tried to wipe at the honey. The cotton fibers stuck to the honey, and the more he tried to wipe, the more fibers separated. Soon, his hands were matted in sticky cotton. Tony looked up at his dad in confusion. Thad broke out and started to laugh, but Tony still didn't understand. His hands looked like he was the abominable snowman or something. Putting a big hand on his back, Thad said to him, "Come on, let's go get you cleaned up." As Thad walked him out to the old pump, Tony was still trying to get the cotton out from between his fingers. Once Tony was cleaned up, they hopped into Mr. Jackson's truck, it being in far better shape than the one Thad had been driving, and headed home. Pulling up in front of his house, Thad could see warm light glowing inside and smoke issuing from the chimney. He found Anita inside cooking eggs while sipping a cup of coffee. She set a plate on the table for Tony, and he dove into them without hesitation. Anita looked up from her son and gave Thad a kiss. "Good morning." They spent the rest of the day moving the things they needed and wanted from their house to the new house. Anita asked Thad about exactly what happened, and he told her everything. Everything except the part about one of the raiders being a young girl and him shooting her in the top of her head as she looked up at him. Thad knew it was a much harder world now, and that Anita would ultimately be faced with it. But he loved her enough to spare her what he could while he could. It was a mutual decision between Thad and Anita to move their bed into the bedroom. They just couldn't bring themselves to sleep in the old man's bed. The next few days they spent settling in. Both of them felt like they were trespassing in the house, but as the days wore on, they became more comfortable. Little Tony was the only one that took to the new house like a fish to water. He was up every morning helping his dad feed all the animals, clean up after them, and perform the general work of maintaining a farm. For the first week after settling in, they saw no one. Chapter 8.
Sarge and the boys had their orders. Against his wishes, Sarge had been pressed into military service again. He was finally convinced when a full-bird colonel made a trip out to the little cabin to press upon him the gravity of the current situation. The colonel reminded Sarge that he had once taken an oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and it was now time to put the latter part of that oath to action. The nation was in turmoil, and the federal government was using the opportunity to purge the land of those they saw as unfit. It was like the Soviet purges or the Civil War all over again. Family was turning on family, friends on friends, and neighbors on neighbors. Sarge's new mission was guerrilla warfare, to be conducted on all FEMA and DHS targets of opportunity. In addition to these two target pools was another that actually disturbed the guys, the U.S. Postal Service. When Mike pressed the colonel as to why they were to target letter carriers, the colonel explained that the Postmaster General had been tasked with finding people and assigning them to work brigades. While on the surface this sounded benign, it was in fact an effort to press people into work camps where there was only one way in and one way out. The government touted these camps as relocation and assistance facilities, but they were internment camps, closer to Soviet gulags than refugee camps. While most of the population was unaware of the operations being conducted, they were starting to come around. In the early days, people had flocked to these camps, where they were processed according to a myriad of factors. It was at one of these processing stations that the seeds of the current course of action had taken root. While some of the military went along with the plan, there were others that saw the situation for what it was and decided their loyalty was to the Constitution and the people of the United States of America. This was the problem that Sarge, Ted, Mike, and Doc found themselves faced with, and they took it on without hesitation. With all this in mind, Sarge held a meeting with the guys to discuss the situation. He told them about the truck at his house and that he wanted to go get it.
"You got to be out of your fucking mind. Wanting to go back to the house after what we did there?" Doc said. "I don't expect to just waltz in there, you fucking potato head. We'll go down to the river and set an observation post and watch it for a couple of days. If it's clear, we'll slip in after dark and get the truck," Sarge said. "Mike, you're going with me. Pack for 3 days. Ted, you'll drop us off, and Doc will hold down the fort."
Mike suggested that they take a radio with them, so if they made contact with unfriendlies, the others could act as a reaction force. Sarge agreed, and they set up a frequency to use in case of emergency. Doc and Ted would monitor the radio 24/7. They packed for 3 days, just in case of an escape and evasion scenario, and they took as much ammo as they could carry. Sarge carried the SPW and a carbine, and Mike took the 203 and an AT-4, along with a couple of claymores. Don had been sent out onto the deck while the guys had their little meeting and finally stuck his head back in the door at the sound of all the activity, asking, "When's lunch?" Sarge gave him a look of disgust and threw an MRE at him. "Here." Don looked at the bag, then looked back at Sarge.
"What's wrong with making some taters and onions?" "We ain't got time for that shit now, and that's as good as it gets at the moment," Sarge said.
Don sat down at the table, muttering to himself about eating out of a damn bag, but settled down to his lunch. While Don ate, the rest continued on preparing for the mission. They had the boat loaded by 4. Sarge wanted to head out about 9 and ordered Mike to get some rack time. Ted and Doc kept watch, and Don was kicked out of the cabin, Sarge giving him a fishing rod to keep him busy. At 9 o'clock, they eased the boat out of the slough into the Suwannee. They ran the boat blacked out, all 3 of them wearing night vision goggles. The trip down the river was uneventful. Sarge paid attention to the houses where he saw the lights, but they were few. Sarge motioned Ted to the side of the river at a bend. His place was just on the other side and down the river about 0.5 mile. The others would walk from there. Sarge reinforced the instructions to monitor the radio and a rough plan of what to do in the event they made contact with the bad guys. With a quick shaking of hands, Mike and Sarge slipped into the night. It took the two of them almost 2 hours to move the 0.5 mile or so to a spot they could see Sarge's house. Even in the dark, Sarge didn't like what he saw. In the greenish glow of the goggles, all he could see where his house had sat on the bank was a big black spot overlooking the river. Mike eased up to Sarge's side.
"Doesn't look good, boss," he whispered.
"About what I expected, but look, the garage is still there. They didn't burn it," Sarge said.
The two of them took a few minutes to set up their hide and settle down for a long look. Sarge set the SPW up to cover the river, and Mike tapped him on the shoulder and whispered in his ear that he was going to set up claymores about 30 yards either side of their position. Sarge gave him a nod, and Mike picked up his pack and moved off into the darkness once again. Sarge unrolled a foam sleep mat and laid it on the ground, then took up a position behind the Minimi. Listening to the pitch dark all around him, Sarge could hear Mike moving around faintly to his right. Mike came back, giving a low hissing whistle so Sarge wouldn't shoot him, then moved off to Sarge's left to set up the other mine. It didn't take him long before he was back in the hide. He was taking a position to watch their six when he tapped Sarge in the shoulder. Sarge looked back at him.
"Hey, what's this? You getting soft?" Mike said in a breathy whisper, jutting a thumb at the foam mat.
Sarge kicked him in his thigh, then whispered back,
"Just wait, dipshit. You'll get old too. Now keep your damn eyes open."
Mike laughed inside, thinking back to the days when the old man would make them lie in the rocks, mud, and thickets on the range, the whole time screaming about not having that fucking sissy mat in the real world. He thought about reminding Sarge of that, but he didn't want to get kicked again. The rest of that night went without incident, with one exception. About 2:30 in the morning, they heard a helo overhead to their south. Even though they scanned the skies with their goggles, they never did see the ship. The only thing worse than hearing a helo working over your head was not knowing where it was or what it was doing. At 5 in the morning, Sarge told Mike to catch a couple hours of sleep. Mike pulled his sleeping bag over him. He knew not to get into it, as it could easily become a body bag if he needed to move quickly. He was out in under 5 minutes. Sarge reached into his pack and pulled out a small stainless thermos of coffee and poured himself a cup. He would stay up and see what the dawn brought. The boat wouldn't be back for them until tomorrow evening, so he had plenty of time.
"Mark looked at me for a minute. He said,
"All right, we'll go have a look, but me and Rick go in, you stay outside."
"Fine by me, boss," I answered.
I had to give Mark credit. What he did next surprised me. He walked over to the people gathered at the back of the truck and called for their attention.
"Listen up, everyone." He paused to give them all a minute. "Considering the situation we're in, everything, even things we previously took for granted, has a new value. We need to utilize every asset we have, take every advantage that comes our way. With that said, and considering what just happened here, we are going to search Pat's house for anything that can be used. We will distribute these items on an as-needed basis, and to ensure that everyone knows what we find, and this is on the up and up, anyone who wants can come with. Rick and I will conduct the search. No one else is going inside, but you will all see what's there. Everyone understand?"
There were several glances in the crowd, and some murmuring, but no one objected.
I guess the thought of getting something overrode their objections to pillaging the house of the dead. Pat's house was less than a block from Mark's, so the walk over was short. Our little procession down the road brought a few more people out of their houses. Pat and her husband had a 10-acre spread. There were 3 horses and a couple of cows, as well as a chicken coop. Most of this, except for the horses, couldn't be seen from the road. But once everyone was past the hedge of cedars, you could see it all. We weren't even in the house yet, and people were already talking about the chickens. Mark and Rick walked up to the front door and brought their weapons up to the ready. Rick reached over and opened the door, and Mark stepped in, sweeping the room with the muzzle of the AR. They were inside for quite a while. The crowd was alive with rumors about what was in there. They were already trying to divvy up the stuff outside the house they could see, like the grill and the tractor. I stayed well off to the side of everyone, just watching and listening. Mark emerged from the house and called me over.
"What's up?"
I asked him, as I walked up, the crowd starting to press in. Mark looked past me and said, "Everyone stay back. No one is going inside. Just wait." Then he looked at me. "I can't fucking believe this. There's a fucking pile of food in here."
"I kind of thought so. What did you find?" I asked.
"There's a pile of canned food and a shelf full of dry beans and rice. I mean, it isn't a mountain or anything, but it is enough to last them several weeks," Mark added, his eyes big, that bewildered look on his face again.
"Well, what are you going to do?"
I asked him. People in the crowd were craning their necks, trying to see into the house.
"Whatever it is, you better do it quick," I added.
"I guess we'll bring it all out and divide it up."
"If I can make a suggestion, bring it all out and pile it up out here so they can all see it. If we can't divide it evenly, and I mean to the ounce, then maybe you should take custody of it, and we work out a way to prepare one meal a day, and everyone comes and gets fed. And think about it this way. If people have to come to you for a meal, that'll reinforce your authority. Having people feel like they owe you can't hurt," I offered.
Mark thought about that for a minute. "That may be best, but if they don't get something today, they may riot. If we're hauling it all out here, they could take it when we're inside, and they might accuse me of taking it. I don't need that kind of trouble."
Danny stepped up. Having been off to the side listening, he said,
"Then have some of them go in and bring it out. Have Rick stay in there to make sure they don't pocket anything, and have someone out here to inventory it all and assign someone else to keep track of the inventory. Make them all part of the system so they can't point fingers."
Mark and I looked at one another, then back at Danny.
"That's a damn good idea," Mark said.
Mark turned and went back into the house to give Rick the plan, then came back out with a notebook and pen in his hand, looking at the crowd as he called out some names.
"Reggie, Louise, can you two come in and help carry some stuff out?"
The two men moved toward the house, and Mark scanned the crowd again.
"Marie, can you come over here and write down everything they take out, what it is and the amount? Get someone to help you if you need."
Marie was the woman who had spoken out about me at Mark's house. She looked around at the people standing around her, waved to another woman, and the two of them went up to Mark and took the notebook and pen. Reggie and Louise started carrying out canned goods and bags of rice, pasta, and beans. The two women noted every item that was carried out, and the items were laid out on the front yard. When it was all said and done, there was a substantial pile of food. It wouldn't feed everyone for very long, but it could for several days. As the spread of food increased, the crowd pressed in. People were talking amongst themselves about what they wanted, how much they would get, and, in a couple of cases, the best way to cook what they saw. Once everything was brought out, the anticipation was building into a fervor in the crowd. It was obvious that some of these people hadn't had much to eat recently. Mark stepped between the crowd and the food and said,
"All right, everyone, back up a little."
Someone from the crowd shouted,
"Just pass it out already."
This was followed with a round of, "Yeah," and other approvals. Mark waved Rick, Danny, and myself over. We joined him in a semicircle.
"All right, everyone can see what's here. Marie, you got it all down?" Mark asked.
Marie held up the notebook.
"Every last ounce," she announced.
"Good. As you can all see, some of this we can't just break up and pass out. So here's what we're going to do. Marie is in charge of the inventory of this food. She will keep track of it and how it's used and how much," Mark called out. Marie had a look of horror on her face.
Mark said, "What we are going to do is secure this food, and we will prepare community meals."
This was met with some jeers and protests. The crowd was turning decidedly hostile. Mark raised his hands, trying to quiet the crowd, but to no avail. Rick fired a shot from his pistol, and they quieted down immediately. Mark looked over his shoulder at Rick and said,
"Thanks, you scared the shit out of me."
That got a few laughs from the crowd. Mark told them,
"Look, if we all take a little of this, then we all might have something today. But if we pool it and prepare community meals, then it will go further. Everyone will get a meal. We're going to track the food, and everyone will know how much is left and how many more meals we can make.
It's the fairest way to do this.
So who decides when we get to eat and what we get to eat? You? Now the law's going to feed us?
Someone from the crowd called out.
Yes, this isn't your food. This belongs to all of us, to the community, our neighborhood, and it must be done equitably and fairly, Mark said.
Well, how are we to know someone isn't taking it when no one's around?
Marie has the list. What's to keep her from taking food? Another voice called out.
I stepped forward and asked, Mark, you going to store this in your shed?
Mark nodded.
Then we'll put two locks on it. Marie will have one key and Mark the other. That way, they both have to be there for the door to be opened, and no one will be in there alone. There were no more objections from the crowd. The last detail to work out was when the community meals would be served and where. Once that was sorted out, Mark asked me to bring my Suburban over, which I did, and then a couple of the guys loaded the food. I drove Mark, Marie, and Reggie back to Mark's house, where all the food was stored. Mark had two new locks in his shop. They were hung on the hasp, and Marie took one set of keys and Mark the other. There weren't any further objections, especially once Mark pointed out the fact that he had just passed out the county food to them all. Not everyone was at the food distribution, but it didn't take long for word to spread that there was food being handed out, and those who weren't there started to trickle into Mark's yard. I told Mark I was done for the day and was going home. He stopped me, saying, "You weren't done yet." "Now what?" I asked.
"You have three bodies that need buried in a decent manner," he said. All I could do was look at him. I just wanted to go home. I was spent, done, and tired.
"Are you serious?"
"Damn right I am. You aren't going to leave them in my yard overnight. You made the mess. You can clean it up."
My head dropped to my chest. The thought of having to dig three graves seemed beyond me right then. Reggie walked over from the shed, where he had finished storing everything, and said,
"I'll help you, Morg."
"There you go. Get it done. It's going to be dark soon," Mark said.
When Mark was gone, Reggie looked over at me.
"Where are we going to plant them?"
"I guess in their property. Let's go over to their house and get some sheets to wrap them up in. Then we'll load them in the Suburban and drive them over." Digging three holes was not on my list of things to do today, I said to Reggie with a sideways glance.
"Well, if I had fuel for my tractor, we could use the bucket to scoop out most of it. That'll make it a hell of a lot easier," Reggie said.
"Tell you what, you go find the sheets and I'll get some fuel," I said. Anything that would keep me from digging until midnight was fine by me.
"Sounds like a plan,"
Reggie said as he started off toward Pat's house. I jumped into the truck and headed toward home. I drove around to the shed where the fuel was stored and parked the truck. In the shop, I found the pump I'd picked up at Harbor Freight, one of the ones that screwed into the bung and had a handle to crank out the fuel. As I was heading back toward the shed, my neighbor Howard called out to me from the fence. I gave him a wave and said I'd be right there and set the pump on the drums and walked over.
"Hey, Morgan. Have you been listening to the radio at all?"
he asked as I came up.
"No, been dealing with other issues."
"Why, what's up?" I asked.
"Just get on the 20-meter tonight and work the band. There's some bad stuff going on, real bad," he said.
"There's bad stuff here, my friend, real bad," I said. Howard just looked at me with a questioning look.
"You'll hear about it soon enough," I told him.
"Yeah. Pat should be down any time to fill me in," Howard said.
"No, she won't either, old buddy."
"Is she all right?" he asked.
"No. Her husband and her son, too," I said.
"What the hell happened?" Howard asked.
"I'll check out the 20-meter tonight. I gotta go right now. Talk to you later," I said as I walked off toward the drums. I had already filled one 5-gallon GI can and was filling the second when I heard a small sniffling voice call out,
"Daddy?"
Looking over my shoulder, I saw little Bit standing there, tears running down her face. Stopping the pumping, I knelt down. She walked over and fell against me, crying.
"What's wrong, baby?" I asked.
Through the sobs and tears, she told me how she was no longer allowed to play with her friends next door.
Their parents told her she was no longer welcome there, and that her father was a horrible man. I squeezed her tight and kissed her on the head. I'm really sorry, honey. Something bad happened today, really bad, and some people are angry at me for it. I did it because they said they were going to hurt me, and I didn't want anything to happen to you, your sisters, and Mommy, I told her, trying to comfort her and at the same time spare her the details. She looked up at me with those tear-stained cheeks. But who am I going to play with now? I'll talk to them and see if we can fix it, okay? Why don't you go inside and ask Mommy to put on a movie for you? What are you doing? Can I come with you? She asked, rubbing her nose. No, baby, I'm sorry. What I have to do, you can't be there, sorry. But I tell you what, tonight we'll play a game together, all of us. They won't play, they never play with me, she said, referring to her sisters. They will tonight, I promise, I said. Okay, Daddy, she said, and gave me a kiss on the cheek. I squeezed her tight again, and she ran toward the house, yelling that she was going to go and pick out a game for us. After finishing the second can, I loaded them into the back of the Suburban and headed for Mark's house. As I approached it, I didn't see Reggie out front, so I passed by and went to Pat's place. Reggie was standing in the front door, with some sheets draped over his arm, looking at something in his hand. I pulled up and called out to him. Jump in and we'll go over to your place and fuel up the tractor. He looked up from whatever it was in his hand, then turned and started toward the truck. Reggie was a big man, a diesel mechanic by trade. He was bald-headed and sported mutton chops. He had Outlaw Biker written all over him. He walked up to the driver's side of the truck and stuck his hand out. He handed me a driver's license. I took it and looked at it. It was a pretty young girl with blonde hair, the sort of woman that would drive the young rednecks around here wild. Who is it? I asked. Stern-faced, he replied, my niece. I looked back down at the little card in my hand. Where'd you find it? I asked, without looking up. Reggie pointed back at the house without looking away. In there. In Randall's room. I looked back up at him. Yeah, well, it wouldn't surprise me, but now we'll never know. If he were still alive, we would. Reggie fixed a cold gaze on me. I handed the card back to him. Well, if you think he had something to do with it, then he's already been dealt with. I hate to say it, and I'm sorry, but she's gone, and nothing's going to change that. He stood there another minute, then walked around and climbed into the passenger's side. He didn't say another word. We fueled the tractor. He drove it back over to Pat's. Then we went over to Mark's and wrapped the bodies in the sheets he took from Pat's house and loaded them into the back of the truck. Back over at Pat's house, Reggie went on to work the pit. He started scooping out the earth, working progressively deeper, like an inverted ramp. With the way he was going, there wouldn't be any hand digging. The sound of the tractor brought people out. A small group gathered and watched as he worked. I guess some were curious. Others were just plain bored, and this was better than the view from the porch. Others were looking decidedly unfriendly. The way Reggie had dug the hole, I was able to back the Suburban down into it. Together, we slid the bodies out one at a time and laid them on the ground, careful not to just toss them or drop them. We laid them out side by side, with Pat in the middle. When I tried to drive the truck out of the hole, it got stuck. Being only two-wheel drive, it slipped in the soft sand. There were some snickers from the gawkers when I got out and went to the back for my tow strap. I didn't have to say anything to Reggie. He was already backing the tractor up to the front end. I put one loop over a tow hook on the front end and dropped the other over a hitch on the back of the tractor, and we pulled it out without incident. Reggie pulled around to the other side of the hole and started pushing the dirt in. He pushed slowly, allowing the earth to roll in and gradually cover the three bodies. As I stood there watching, I thought back to James and his tractor doing the same thing. I wondered how he and Miss Edith were doing. I missed them and the time I had spent with them. A wave of uncertainty washed over me. How many was it now? 6? 7? I ran through it in my head. No, It was 8, or more. At least 8 people I had killed. And why? What kind of person could kill that many people? I thought back to earlier in the day, and looking down at Pat. That, and the impact of the bullet. What had I done? I had to, didn't I? There was nothing to stop them from doing what they had threatened to. It wasn't like I could have called the sheriff and had a restraining order placed on them. Not that that even worked before. And it wasn't that I had been making a point. I didn't doubt that Randall and Leland would have lain in wait for me. Maybe not today or this week, but eventually. But could it have gone differently? I was still standing there when Reggie shut the tractor down. I looked at the smoothed-over fresh dirt and couldn't even remember the hole being filled. Reggie walked up to me and stood there, looking at the spot. He said, "I hope we don't have to do this too many more times." I looked over at him. He was still looking at the bare dirt. I said, "Me too. Thanks for the help. I really appreciate it." "No problem. The way I figure it, you need all the friends you can get around here right now," he said, finally looking over at me. I glanced up and nodded my head. One of the onlookers called out, "Is anyone going to say anything for them?" No one spoke up. The few that were there just looked at the bare soil, then at me. I walked over to the Suburban and drove home. It was almost dark by the time I got into the house. Mel was in the kitchen fixing dinner, chili with rice. She asked, "You okay? What happened today?" I looked at her and said, "I just don't feel like talking about it right now." She stood there looking at me for a minute, then gave me a hug and stepped up onto her toes and kissed me. "You hungry? You never came for lunch." I was starving, and I told her so. But first I needed a drink. Going out to the shop, I pulled some buckets out from under the shelves, then got on my hands and knees and pulled a case of Benchmark Number 8 out. It was cheap whiskey that I had bought on a whim and put away for just in case. And today was just the sort of case that called for it. Mel came into my shop before I got a chance to open the case. "Gonna come in and eat?" she asked. "Yeah, I guess so." She was standing in the door looking at me. "What's wrong? What happened?" I didn't want to have this talk with her, but there was no way around it. Better she hear it from me. "Okay, hang on a second, though," I said, and went back and opened the case, pulled out a bottle, and walked over and leaned against the workbench. Mel looked at me like my head was on sideways when I unscrewed the bottle and took a shot. I held the bottle out to her. "Want one?" She just shook her head at me with a look somewhere between curious and annoyed. "You might want one when I'm done," I said. I went into what had happened, from the trip to town to the return, and what had happened at Mark's house and afterward. I told her what Randall and Leland had said, what Pat had said, and then, of course, what happened next. She stood there looking at me, her eyes growing wider as I went along. When I got to the shootings, her hands went to her mouth. She stood there without saying a word. When I finished, she was still standing there with her hand covering her mouth and her eyes wide. I picked up the bottle and took another shot. She finally came out of it. "Can't believe you did that. What's going to happen?" "I don't know," I answered. "Are you going to go to jail?" she asked. That actually made me smile. It was just another example of how people were not coming to the realization of just what was going on. "No, honey, I'm not going to jail. But there are some people that are not happy about it, so we need to be careful," I told her. We went inside, where a bowl of chili sat at the table waiting for me. I asked Mel where the girls were, and she told me they were all in their rooms reading or something. I ate my dinner without much enthusiasm. When I was done, I went into the girls' rooms to check on them. The two big girls were both reading books. I talked to each of them for a minute, lying on their beds to spend a couple of minutes with each of them. Little Bit was in her bed, with a Bass Pro Shop Monopoly game in her arms, sound asleep. I slipped the game out and covered her up, then went out to the living room. Mel was sitting on the couch reading a book as well. I sat down for a minute, then I told her I was going to go out to the shop and listen to the radio for a while. I just couldn't sit inside right then. Bring some wood back in when you come. There isn't any more in the deck, she said, as I stood up to go.
Okay.
Back out in the shop, I turned on the radio and spun the top off the bottle. I poured a couple of fingers of whiskey into a canteen cup and started to scan the frequencies. The traffic on the radio was really picking up. I heard people from several states. Even though radios had been outlawed, it didn't appear to be stopping anyone from transmitting. Most of the talk was what you would expect. Conditions where the various people were, food situations, water situations, and security. Rumors were being exchanged about where food was being distributed or where the government was using force. This was a little disturbing to hear, that they were actually going after people. I wanted to ask questions, but wasn't about to transmit. Sarge had made it clear about how careful I had to be, and that thought made me think of him and the guys, where they were and what they were doing, how they were doing. I was roused from my thoughts of the guys when I heard someone talking about a mailman. They reported seeing a mail truck go down their road with a uniformed mailman driving it. This brought about a lively conversation about whether or not the government was starting to function, some saying it was now just a matter of time before the power would come back on and things would start to get back to normal. The chatter on the radio deteriorated on the frequency I was listening to, so I started to scan through the band. It wasn't long before I found another that caught my attention when I heard mailman again. Stopping on the frequency for a second, I heard the end of the exchange. Asked me a bunch of questions and was filling out a form. What'd he ask you? What I did for a living? Did we have any food? Then he asked if I had any guns. That's when I told him it was none of his business. Then this other feller got out of the Jeep and came up. He was wearing a uniform and carrying a rifle, and he told me to settle down and answer the questions. What'd you do? I called my boys out of the house. Then I told them to get the hell off my land. Did they leave? Damn straight they did. This conversation, too, went off in another direction, so I just shut the radio down. Draining the canteen cup, I went inside. Chapter 9. Thad and Anita had been in the house for almost a week when Pastor Fish showed up one afternoon. Thad was out back cleaning out the pig pen when Pastor Fish came out the back door and called to him. Thad looked up, leaning on the shovel he was using, and waved a greeting. He met the pastor as he crossed the yard toward the pen. "How you doing, Thad?" Pastor Fish said, sticking out his hand. "Good, Pastor Fish. How you doing?" "Fair to middling. How's things here?" "Good as can be, considering what brought us here," Thad replied. The pastor's face turned sour. "What happened?" Thad told him everything, except what Mr. Jackson had said about the girl and the way she had died. He pulled his arm out of his coat to show the wound where the piece of bullet still resided. Pastor Fish took Thad's arm in his hand and looked at it. "Thad, that's starting to look angry. You taking anything for it?"
"No, sir. Ain't got any antibiotics." "We'll see what we can do about that. Where'd you bury Mr. Jackson?"
Thad motioned for him to follow and led the pastor to the oak tree where he had buried the old man. The two men stood there for a couple of minutes, not saying anything. The pastor took a look around the area, then said, "You couldn't have picked a better spot. It's a wicked world we're living in nowadays."
"Getting worse every day, too," Thad said.
The two men walked back up to the house in silence. As they came up to the back porch, they could hear voices in the front side of the house. The two men shared a quick glance, and Thad drew his Glock, which he always carried now. He walked around the side of the house. Pastor Fish stayed behind Thad as he peeked around the corner. Holstering the pistol, Thad and the pastor stepped out to see Anita talking with a uniformed man.
"Is that a mailman?" the pastor asked.
"Sure looks like it."
Anita saw them coming, and Thad could see some apprehension on her face as he approached. The man looked up as the two of them came up.
"Good morning," he said with a smile.
After a brief exchange of niceties, the man got down to business. The postmaster had been tasked with conducting a census of sorts, to figure out where people were, what their skills were, and most importantly, what their needs were. The uniformed man went down a form, asking questions and making notations on it. When Thad asked what they needed all this information for, the answer to the question caused the three of them to share a quick glance. With a smile on his face, the uniformed man replied, "To facilitate the relocation of people to the area where they will be able to provide the most benefit to the reconstruction of our nation." He said it as an actor would recite a well-rehearsed line, or like a used car salesman trying to close a deal. Thad looked the man straight in the eyes. "We don't plan on going anywhere. We're taking care of ourselves, and we'll continue to do so. Thank you for coming out." He put an arm around Anita and turned toward the house, motioning with his head for the pastor to follow. As Pastor Fish stepped by the uniformed man, the man stepped in front of him and asked, "Where do you live?" Again with that plastic smile on his face. Thad motioned for Anita to go into the house and step between the two men. "I'm going to ask you to leave now." The man took a step back, still smiling, and flipped through the papers on his clipboard. Looking down at the sheaf of papers, the man asked, "Where is Mr. Jackson?" Thad took a step toward the man, but Pastor Fish put a hand on his shoulder. Thad looked at the brother, who nodded with his head toward the road. Standing by one of the old-style mail jeeps was another man. This one wore a military-style uniform and carried an assault rifle. Thad turned, and the brother put a hand on his shoulder again, and the two of them walked toward the house. From behind them, the mailman called out, "You will be receiving a letter in the coming days with instructions. Failure to follow them will be..." The man paused for a moment. "Unpleasant, to say the least. There are jobs that most would rather not have. Do you understand?" Thad and the brother continued into the house, Thad shutting and locking the door behind them. Inside, Anita was in a near panic. "What are we going to do? They can't just send us off to work someplace, can they?" The brother spoke up before Thad could. "If martial law had been declared, then they could." "Well, they already did that," Thad said. The old brother looked over at Thad in surprise. "How do you know?" "I have a radio, and someone I trust told me."
"You have a two-way?" the brother asked.
"Yeah, I got it on my way home. My friend gave it to me." Anita said, "What are we going to do, Thad?" The conversation went on for some time between the three of them, trying to figure out what they should do. Anita's biggest concern was that they might be split up and sent to different places. Thad tried to assure her that that would never happen, and Anita reminded him he was useless to them dead. Thad sat there for a minute, chewing on that. "I'm going to set up the radio. I need to talk to some folks, if I can reach them," he said. Ted showed up at the boat the next evening. They hadn't seen anything to make them think there was anyone around. Sarge figured the DHS goons weren't worried about it, since they had torched the place. Using the boat to cross the river, Sarge slipped up to the little garage that sat between the river and the scorched spot where his house had once stood. Pulling the door open, he saw the old truck was still sitting there. The truck was an old Dodge Power Wagon that Sarge had owned before he went into the Army. It had spent many, many years in storage. Since his retirement, Sarge had spent some time getting it back into running order. A new Crate 360 sat under the hood now, and the rest of the running gear had been rebuilt and were now as good as the day they had come off the line in Detroit. What he had not spent any time on was the looks of the beast. It was mostly a flat black of sorts, and the interior was in wretched condition, with the spring showing through the seats. The rotor cap and the coil were in an old Glad garbage bag box on a shelf. Sarge pulled the box down and installed the two pieces in a matter of moments. Ted and Mike stood watch, Mike out front and Ted behind the building watching the river. After a quick check with the two guys to make sure the coast was clear, Sarge cranked the old truck. Dead, not even a click. Sarge ran out to Mike and told him to go pull one of the batteries from the boats and get it back up here pronto. Mike did as instructed,
giving Ted a quick rundown on his way. Mike had the battery back in a few minutes, and Sarge hit the key. This time, the truck cranked for a minute, then fired to life. Sarge feathered the gas for a moment, the old beast revving its response. Satisfied it was ready, Sarge stepped out to Mike and told him to get Ted and head for the swamp. He would meet them on the old road they had scouted prior to this little exercise.
"Be careful. If anything happens, call us and we'll be there," Mike said.
"Just keep the radio on. Let's go," Sarge replied.
Mike gave him a nod and jogged around the garage. Once they were in the boats and turned out into the river, Sarge grabbed his gear and tossed it into the truck. Opening his pack, he pulled an old flannel shirt out, then took off his vest and threw it on the front seat and put the flannel on. Swapping his boonie hat for one of his 101st trucker-style hats, he would look like any other old cracker driving down the road, if there were any driving. When he made it to the gate, he found it had been pulled down by something heavy. The 6x6 posts anchoring either end of it were pulled completely out of the ground, and the gate lay twisted and mangled. Then he spotted something in a tree, and he climbed out to look at it. It was a wanted poster. Actually, it was several, like the ones he had seen for the FBI's Most Wanted, only this one had his picture and name on it. The others had photos of Mike, Ted, and Doc on them. Their posters gave their names and ranks and labeled them as deserters and armed and dangerous. The line under Wanted made his blood run cold. It said, "Dead or alive." Sarge was standing in the road beside the truck, looking at the poster, and suddenly became aware of the rumble coming from the two Thrush glass packs on the old truck. Looking down the road, he saw a man he recognized as one of his neighbors standing in the road, looking at him. Looking back to the poster in his hands for a moment, he read the part about the reward. Instead of cash, the reward was offered in food credits redeemable at any FEMA facility. Lowering the poster, Sarge looked down the road again. The man was still there, but he put his hands in his pockets and walked off the road, trying too hard to look casual. Climbing up into the truck, Sarge put it in gear and deliberately drove toward the man's house. Coming abreast of the house, he saw the guy still in his yard. Sarge pushed the clutch in and gunned the engine, looking right at the guy, who quickly went inside. Seeing the mistake of those glass packs clearly now, he took a bit of a roundabout way out of the area, knowing anyone around could easily hear the old beast. He was on edge for the entire drive to the rendezvous with Mike and Ted. The more he thought about it, though, the less it seemed to him like there would be anyone out here looking for him. Sarge knew the DHS just didn't have the personnel to watch these sticks too closely. They would let their reward offer do the work for them. Rounding the corner where he was to meet the guys, Sarge saw the trees move out from in front of his truck. He was impressed with Ted for this one. Instead of cutting brush to build a blind for the truck, Ted had dug up some of the small pines and planted them in 5-gallon buckets, then dug holes in the ground for the buckets to fit in. After driving in, the guys dropped the buckets back in the holes and spread pine needles out at their bases. Sarge got out, popped the hood, and grabbed a piece of wire from the seat. Mike came over to him and asked, "What are you doing?"
"Just a little surprise for anyone who tries to start the truck," Sarge answered.
He went around to the front of the truck and fished the wire through the firewall, telling Mike to find it and pull it through. Once the wire was pulled into the cab, he connected the other end to the coil after stripping it. Inside the cab, he stripped that end and wrapped it around one of the seat springs from the bottom. He rerouted the positive side to the ignition. If anyone tried to start it, not only would they get the shock of their life, but the horn would sound too. The three of them quickly spread the camo net Sarge had over the truck and headed back to the shack. He told them about the posters. Doc seemed to take it worse than the other two, who brushed it off with typical morbid humor.
"So now everyone is looking for our scalps in exchange for a can of beans," Doc said.
"Well, get used to it, son. This is only the beginning. Gonna get a lot worse soon enough," Sarge said.
"Well, thanks for that. Really cheered me up,"
Sarge said.
Look at it this way. This makes it easier for us.
Doc looked at him like he was stupid, and Sarge said,
Anyone we come across is either for us or against us. No gray area now.
Doc said,
You may be ready to kill everyone you meet, but I'm not. Everything I've ever done was aimed at protecting these people.
Sarge said,
Let me make this very fucking clear right now. I don't want to kill everyone I come across. You and I both took an oath once. All enemies, foreign and domestic. I've done my part for the foreign ones. Now comes the time to deal with the domestic. Anyone who isn't part of the solution to the current problem is part of the fucking problem, and will be dealt with accordingly.
He paused for a moment to look at all three men.
No quarter will be given. None will be expected. You all heard what the colonel said. We have a defined enemy. We have a defined mission.
He paused again and looked squarely at Doc, his expression softening some.
You want to overthink this. I get that. It's the way you're built. So think about it this way. How many times have you wondered why the average German didn't stand up to Hitler? Lots, I bet. I know I have. And I don't know the answer to that. But I do know I'm not going to have people 50 or 100 years from now asking the same thing about me.
Mike reached out and slapped Doc in the back.
Come on, man.
Doc said,
I'm with you.
Sarge put a hand on his shoulder.
Ain't no one asking you to like it. I sure as hell don't. Just keep thinking about who we're doing this for. Friends, family, anybody under the DHS boot.
Yeah, which reminds me, I got a call from Thad earlier, Doc said.
Sarge asked,
How's he doing?
Not good. Said a mailman came by his place and was asking a lot of questions. Basically told them they may be relocated to areas where their skills would be best utilized for the common good.
Damn! They're moving faster than I thought they would, Sarge said, looking down at the trail as he walked.
You expected it? Doc asked.
Well, sorta, yes. Under martial law, the postmaster can be tasked with conducting a census and compiling lists for things like work details and relocation. I guess they're getting to work on it already. Shit. I really thought it would take them longer. How many of them were there?
Sarge said.
He said there was one guy in a postal uniform and one in a DHS uniform who was covering him. The guy told them they'd be getting a letter in the next few days with instructions. And then there were threats. He wanted to know what you thought he should do.
Sarge walked for a moment and then said,
We'll have to think on that one for a while.
Chapter 10 The next week went by without much happening. Food was the growing concern for almost everyone in the neighborhood. We had managed to conserve ours and were in pretty good shape, especially since I had shot a deer one night in the front yard. I'd been sitting on the porch when I heard something and clicked on my flashlight and saw three sets of lights shining out in the yard. At first, I was shocked to see them there. After all, with so many hungry people out there, I thought the deer would have been wiped out. But there they were. I stepped inside and got my .22. It was an old Mossberg bolt action. The best part about it was the scope I'd put on it. It had an illuminated reticle that used a 2032 coin-style battery. Turning the sight to the lowest setting, I held the flashlight in one hand and propped the rifle on the porch rail. Centering the crosshairs between the set of glowing eyes, I fired a stinger. The other two immediately bolted and were gone. I found the deer right where it had bedded down for the night. Since it was so cold out still, I gutted the deer, saving all the organs except for the digestive tract, and hung it high in a tree where I usually processed deer for the night. All the organs I took inside and put in a bowl in the fridge. My plan was to save them for the dogs, as dog food was getting scarce. Hanging the deer had unintended consequences, as the neighbors to my east saw it the next day. This just added to the hard feelings in the neighborhood. I'd killed a deer and everyone knew I had meat. They already suspected that I had other food, since I didn't take any of the food Mark got from the county. Maybe I should have, but it felt like the right thing to do. It was 5 more meals a day for those in the community when my family wasn't there in line. But it didn't gain me any points with anyone. Mark, Danny, Rick, and Reggie were the only ones that would work the barricade with me, or even speak to me for that matter. When I was butchering the deer, I took a ham over to my neighbor and offered it to him. He refused, acting like the meat was tainted. I just looked at him and said, "Then just let the kids eat it. They won't care." He finally relented and took the meat after looking back at his 2 children playing in the yard. They already looked skinnier than I had ever seen them. Even the act of generosity didn't help, and it seemed to only make matters worse. Danny and I were on the barricade one morning early, when some of the folks from down the road came up. They were going to go out hunting in the forest down the road a bit. "Where are you guys headed?" Danny asked. One of the 3 men, one from down on Danny's end of the road, replied, "We're going to go and see if we can kill something, anything to eat." He paused for a moment and looked at me. "We can't all kill him in our front yard." I thought I would offer some helpful advice, maybe try and break the tension. "Try looking for them at night with a flashlight. That's how I got mine." "Well, that'd be great if I had batteries for a flashlight," the man replied. And then the 3 of them walked through the barricade, heading toward the forest. I looked over at Danny. How in the hell can they be pissed that I got a kill? It's not like I took it from one of them. "They all think you have a mountain of food you're sitting on." What Pat said really stirred them up. "Some of them feel like you killed them just to shut them up." "That's not why I did it, and you know it," I said. "I do, you do, but that's about it. And you gotta admit, it was fucked up. If I hadn't have done it, they would have done me just to get what they think I have. Hell, you have almost as much as we do. Why aren't they beating your door down?" Danny gave an evil little grin. "I guess 'cause you killed Pat before she could talk about me." We stood in silence for a few minutes, and then Danny said we should start a fire in the barrel. As he was putting together the makings of a fire, I thought I heard something. "Hey man, you hear that?" Danny stopped what he was doing and walked over to where I was standing, cocking his head to listen. "Yeah, I do. What is it?" The sound was a low rumble of sorts, but was definitely getting louder. "Almost sounds like a big truck," I said. "Yeah, it does." We stood there listening for a few minutes, the sound getting louder, until there was no doubt that's what it was. It didn't take long before we could see the truck coming down the road, heading north on 19. "Check this shit out," I said. As we stood there, a large tanker truck came rumbling past us. It was escorted, front and rear, by Humvees. As the Hummers came toward us, the gunners in the turrets trained their weapons on us. We both stepped back from the barricade with our hands held up in front of our chests. The M249s mounted to the turrets were way more hardware than I wanted to tangle with. The rear gunner kept his weapon on us until they were out of sight down the road. Danny and I exchanged looks. "What was that?" Danny asked. "Had to be a fuel truck. That's the only thing that would warrant that kind of security. You know folks would do about anything for several thousand gallons of gas right about now," I said. "You're probably right. But where was it going? And why was it coming through here?" Danny asked. "The only thing I can think of is the bombing range. Remember those guys I told you about, the ones that tried to shoot down the helicopter? They said there was something going on over there on the range. Maybe that's where it was headed. But why come through here? And where was it coming from? There's a fuel depot in South Orlando, but I would have thought that was used up long ago by now." "Maybe coming from Tampa and just varying the route to prevent ambush," I said. Danny went back to making the fire, and we didn't talk about it anymore. I made a mental note to tell Mark about it, for no real reason, other than the curiosity factor. For most of the morning, the sound of a chainsaw had come from Old Man Howard's house. He was busy cutting wood, and from the sound of it, a lot of it. The saw would run for a while, then stop for a while, in irregular intervals, but always in the same manner. You can tell when he had cut enough to stack or haul, or whatever he was doing with it. so when the saw stopped abruptly, I turned to look back that way. With the saw stopped, it was quiet, the air was cool, and it was a nice morning. Then the air was ripped by a blood-curdling shriek, followed by shrill, short screams. I took off at a run toward Howard's house. It was one up from mine toward 19. His gate was closed and locked, but I was over it in a flash. As I ran up his drive, I saw his wife on her knees, off to the side. She was holding Howard, and she was covered in blood. I skidded to a stop on my knees beside her. Howard was on the ground, his right leg severed just below the knee. He had his hands wrapped around his leg just above the knee, but with every beat of his heart,